Good morning, and welcome to another Tuesday edition of the Community Conversation / Morning Show. And how long, Julie, can you go on doing the in-studio hosting? I think you're on mute.
Oh, well, forever, except when I'm on vacation, Phil. How are you?
I'm good, except I'm sweltering. Yeah. And as everybody knows, we pre-record these things. So Julie and I are coming to you from the latter days of June, where it was record-breaking heat, unless that record's broken once again between now and next Tuesday.
Yes. Hey, Phil, I've got to tell you this. I have never had an 80-degree temperature inside my house until today. It's terrible, and I hope it's not the case when this is when this is played next Tuesday. I'm fingers crossed that it'll have cooled off just a little bit.
Time to hit the lake. I think that's what we're going to be doing this long fourth weekend.
I wanted to tell you, Phil, that I went in four bodies of water yesterday, and it was only like 102. I was in the Pendere River in two spots, Lake Kokolala and the Lake Pendere. So I don't know how I'm going to top that for the rest of the hot streak.
I think just level it off, and that would be really, really good. Well, we are in the throes of what many would call a climate change-induced heat wave, certainly the longest, hottest, most persistent, widest heat wave in the inland Pacific Northwest. And although that's not exactly what we're here to talk about today, we are going to be looking at a species who's being extirpated from their range, as they'd say, and nearing extinction level, and climate change does play into that. So with no further ado, let's introduce today's topic and guests. We're really fortunate to have Chris Lamb and Jack Kretel, University of Idaho English graduates, recent graduate students, or recent students who have graduated from a Master's of English program. And they're going to be talking about the storytelling of extinction, responding to the loss of North Idaho's mountain caribou. Good morning, Chris. Good morning, Jack. Let's start with you, Chris. Let's hear your voice.
Morning.
Jack.
Yes. Morning. Nice to meet you both.
Okay. Well, we'd like to start with just a little bit deeper dive. Why don't you each go into a little bit about yourselves, where you're from, why you decided to attend the University of Idaho, your academic careers and interests in general. What brought you to this moment? And Chris, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I'm from, I grew up in New Hampshire, and I studied after a long career as a semi-professional ski jumper, went to college at a small liberal arts school in Vermont that allowed me to study at the intersection of environmental studies, philosophy, and literature, doing kind of interdisciplinary work in environmental studies, what we describe here and now as environmental humanities. And when I finished my undergrad, I was kind of just felt like I was just at the beginning of pursuing some questions about my own relationship to an environment that is rapidly changing around me, and finding the humanities lens as a kind of a fruitful and exciting way to explore those questions. And so I sought out programs that would allow me to continue on that path. And the University of Idaho has a unique focus in the environmental humanities here in the English program. A lot of professors here who specialize in environmental literature, place-based literature, climate change studies. And so, yeah, I thought this, my goal is ultimately to do a PhD and to teach in higher education. And I thought this would be a great stepping stone to kind of do some research and gain a stronger foundation in interdisciplinary approaches to environmental issues.
Great. Jack, tell us your story.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jack. And I split time growing up in the San Fernando Valley, which is part of the greater Los Angeles area, and central Pennsylvania, in a small town called Bellefonte. And my first contact with extinction probably occurred when I was a kid, when my mother took me to the La Brea tar pits in downtown Los Angeles, which is a natural tar seep where a number of megafauna from the Pleistocene area would get trapped, and then their bones would become kind of stuck in this tarry substance, and then excavated later on and displayed in a museum. And so I was obsessed with these bones as a child. And then later on, my family relocated to central Pennsylvania, and I went to school at Penn State. I did an undergraduate in English, and I also spent a lot of time running around the woods, hunting and fishing. And those pursuits, English, the physical environment, led me to the University of Idaho, to the English program, which has a strong interest in the environmental humanities, as Chris identified. And yeah, here I am.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to me, I've got to say, because it's a wonderful thought to be combining the science of knowing what's happening in the environment with extinctions, and in this case, extirpations, your project, and then with a way to communicate that to others through the humanities. I can't wait to hear more about it. I'd like for one of you to give us a big picture overview of this project. Tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, I thought maybe I could say something about mountain caribou first, just an outline. But basically, southern mountain caribou, which is what used to live in North Idaho and extreme northeastern Washington, are a distinct population or ecotype of woodland caribou, which is a subspecies. And these were the last caribou to inhabit the lower 48. There were previously caribou throughout New England and the upper Midwest, but these animals were extirpated by the start of the 20th century, and those were woodland caribou. And mountain caribou are unique in that they're not gregarious like barren ground caribou, which is, I think, what a lot of us imagine when we think of caribou, vast herds of 100,000 individuals moving across a landscape. Mountain caribou are the polar opposite of that. They live in small family units of 8 to 10 individuals, and they migrate vertically up and down mountains rather than horizontally across the landscape. And so they're a very unique critter. And perhaps most unique of all is that they migrate up into the high country during the winter months, where they use their oversized hooves to get along the snowpack and eat arboreal lichens. That's kind of an overview of mountain caribou ecology. And Chris, if you want to touch on the kind of formal response that we came up with to the extirpation.
Yeah. So that, as the title to our project indicates, we've thought of it as a response, as a community response to the local extinction or extirpation of this particular species or subspecies of caribou that used to inhabit the South Selkirks of Idaho. And this kind of piqued our interest in, I think for Jack, it extends a little bit farther back in time, but for me was an article that we both came across. It was a January 2019 article written published in the Statesman and written by Rocky Barker that described the kind of official extirpation event, the last remaining caribou, which were actually airlifted out of Idaho and brought into a captive breeding program in BC because there was no longer a viable population after many attempts and years to augment the herd. And this was kind of a striking image, and Jack and I had read this article and talked about both how unique it was to have had mountain caribou, this kind of unique ecotype or subspecies of caribou in our backyards, and also to think about, you know, this shocking, almost violent seeming removal of them. And so we thought about this moment of removal as kind of as a call to response, as a moment or a point of departure for a project. And we thought, well, this could be we'd been thinking about trying to do a research project together. We have very similar interests. We're taking a lot of the same courses. And we thought this could be something that we could dive into a bit further. So we took this moment of departure, this moment of removal, and decided that we would try to come up with a way to respond to this extinction event and produce a community response. And we're doing this in the form of we've done this in the form of a deep map, which is a kind of multidimensional spatial narrative. It's a kind of a representation of space that's more qualitative than quantitative, that is not attempting, like traditional maps, to represent space as merely a surface, but to try to give it depth and to think of space as a storied phenomenon that has kind of multiple layered ongoing stories, which are the stories of various animal inhabitants of a space, other kind of organic matter and human inhabitants, and kind of looking at the ways in which those stories overlap and kind of form and shape one another. And so the deep map that we've produced is trying to represent the space where caribou were removed from, the space that they formerly inhabited in the absence of caribou. And so what we've done is we've collected over 20 oral histories from Idaho residents who have either worked on caribou recovery efforts. These are wildlife biologists, for fish and game conservation officers, and also Idaho locals who have had encounters with caribou in the wild. So a large number of these oral histories are short stories of people who went hiking up to Two Mouth Lakes outside of Bonner's Ferry or Beehive Lakes or Chimney Rock, and happened to, on one particular day, stumble upon a caribou that was, you know, grazing or drinking at the lake. And so what we've done, in addition to these oral histories, we've also collected a large number of game camera images and videos from former caribou range that kind of represent the animals that currently inhabit that space without caribou, and we've embedded these on a satellite base layer map and geolocated them, oral histories in the spaces where they happened, and people can open this map and kind of click on a node that'll pop up the video of the oral history. Or the game camera, and you can basically explore and get lost in this space. And the idea, as I mentioned before, is to kind of to present an encounter with an animal that is no longer there, right? People go to this website and are thinking about caribou. It's about caribou, but they never actually see a caribou. Which is kind of the reality. And so the point is to kind of make the reality of this absence or this extinction event felt in a way that kind of begs the question of what do we do? How do we live in a world without this animal. Sorry if that it gets kind of abstract and theoretical and so.
Yeah. It's great though. What a great description, Phil.
It's a wonderful sounding project. There's so many questions we can delve into, but I think I'd like to start with getting a good handle on the audience's experience of this. And from what you've said, what I've read, this isn't your grandfather's fold-out highway map. This is a digital map, and you're going to a website, and it's interactive. You're clicking on something to get the photo images, and perhaps or probably the audio files also. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. A deep map is not completely different from a traditional map, but unlike a traditional map, a deep map has additional rhetorical layers that have to do with a person's encounter of that space. So it's both a traditional representation of space. In our case, it's a GIS kind of Google Earth-like layer. In addition to a number of experiences that occurred in that space, so it's the representation plus the content of that space as it's experienced or related by another person, and so yeah, it's a complex rhetorical form. But it's useful for our purposes because it's able to hold all of these different individual voices.
So
my thoughts, I'm sorry to interrupt, Phil, but I'm thinking it could be a little bit like a ghost town of the what's happened with the caribou or something else, almost like a, I don't know. It's a form of story that we haven't experienced before. I love the idea.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. And so many questions about what's gone into it and how you've put it together. Also, for now, listeners are probably curious about where they can experience it. Is it available yet? Is it online and released to the general public, or are you still in production mode?
We are. So there is a link that people can visit, a site that has almost a complete product. It is still ongoing. We're still trying to polish it up and make it more user friendly. So we welcome people to visit it. We want people to visit it with that in mind, understanding that it's still a work in progress.
Yeah, and the website is https storying.onrender.com.
Okay, repeat that for me.
Storying.onrender, onrender.com. And we encourage people to browse the site. The map also consists of two long nonfiction narratives that Chris and I wrote under the tabs Mountains and Valleys that are a reflexive component of the map that relate the stories of the collection of data and everything else involved. Basically, they're narratives about our own participation in building this map. And together, the whole thing is what we would call the deep map.
Okay, Phil, I'd like for you to share a little bit of background from our community, because I'm thinking maybe in 2019, we were interviewing biology research folks about what was going to happen with this tiny population of caribou. So bring us back to that time.
We did. In fact, 2019 was probably the last time we profiled a show about the caribou. And at that time, the folks we were talking to were from the Kalispell tribe, as well as some local conservation groups. And they were engaging in a project to capture the last females and put them in a winter pen so they could give birth under controlled conditions. And as I recall, the project met with a great degree of challenge because it was a high snow year such that the pens did not work effectively. And when that failed, then the population further collapsed. The remaining handful of individuals were, as you've already noted, captured and transported up to British Columbia. So It was, even then, as described, a last-ditch effort, really, at recovering the population without augmenting the population.
Right. We were gathering bags of, lichen, moss. Sphagnum moss is off the trees. It was quite an interesting attempt, of course.
Right, because, of course, if they're penned up, they don't have the ability to source their own food. So there was quite an effort to gather a huge volume. I forget the number of lichen collections that went out, but it was just an incredible volume of lichen that needed to be collected to essentially provide food for the surviving few caribou. And again, unfortunately, it didn't work. I would imagine that's one of the stories you've uncovered somewhere. And,
yeah. I mean, that's a fascinating component, and it's the extirpation of caribou is a very complex story, and it reveals that extirpation is greater than just one individual species. Species belong to ecologies and ecosystems, and so I think with the reintroductions, we learned the hard way that you can't just sprinkle caribou on a landscape and hope that they adhere. We have to look at the entire ecosystem, which includes us, and kind of look at our own interests and behaviors and try to manage it from there.
So I'm curious to hear more about how you went about collecting the data, the camera data, the story data. Tell us about the research hours and methods and what all went into it. It sounds like a massive effort.
Yeah, so this project was supported by the Center for Digital Inquiry and Learning at the University of Idaho Library. It's in essence a digital humanities project, interdisciplinary digital humanities project. And so they kind of funded us, basically giving us gas money, helping us purchase some of the supplies that we needed, which we then took. So the game camera footage collection took place in, obviously, the Selkirk Mountains, and we spent we took 5 or 6 separate trips into various parts of the Selkirk, starting in what was kind of the designated critical caribou habitat, which was 30,000 acres in around Little Snowy Top Mountain, kind of right up Little Snowy and Big Snowy Top Mountain, right on the Canadian border, on the northwest of Priest Lake. And so we went up there, I think 3 or 4 times, and basically went as far as we could. It took several attempts to even get close to the critical habitat, because it was a 10, 11 mile hike to get to what we thought was kind of the center of this space, or the space where the last sighting of caribou actually took place in the lower 48. And so that's where we wanted to start. We felt like it was an appropriate place to go. So we went up there. We started at the end of May, which brought us to snow-covered mountains and very difficult terrain. And then we went back a month later to what were still snow-covered mountains and very difficult terrain. And didn't actually have a snow-free trip into those mountains until late July. But we were looking for game trails and funnels and different kind of features in the geography that indicated a lot of animal activity. And that's where we would hang these trail cams. And so we'd go up there, we'd bring 6 trail cams, we'd hang them in different locations kind of around the area where we camped. And then we would leave and come back 3 weeks, a month later, collect the data from those cameras, move them to a different location. In between these trips to Little Snowy Top in the critical caribou habitat, we also went over to the Selkirk Crest and to places like such as Two Mouth Lakes and Ball Creek, where we learned was where they did the soft release of caribou when they were translocating caribou from British Columbia to augment the herd in the late 80s.
Okay, and you weren't hoping to get to capture caribou on these game cams, obviously. So what were you hoping to gather?
We were hoping to just document the current inhabitants of the space and to provide a picture of the more than human and human community that lives there in the absence of caribou, as well as to document changes to the landscape, which were important or at least consequential in the extirpation of caribou, such as the greater number of early sterile stage forests, the greater number of white-tailed deer, elk, and moose, which brought a suite of predators into contact with caribou and basically eliminated them.
So were you able to find or identify resources for a layer of the map that might show old archival photos, whether they were game cameras or individuals who got lucky enough? Are there images of caribou on the map somewhere?
We have a few images that we've included in some of the videos that we put together for the oral histories from Paul Flynn, was a Boundary County game warden who was very involved. He was, I would consider, a caribou activist in the 50s and 60s. And he documented caribou in Boundary County and took a lot of photographs and actually had video footage at one point that has since been lost. But we included some of those really beautiful black and white photographs that Paul took in some of these oral histories. And we also have one oral history from Bryce Comer, who is he's a documentary film guy up in Southern BC. And he produced a film on the mountain caribou. I think it was in the early 2000s, and he provided us with one video. I think that's the only video we have of a caribou. There's a cow and calf in that film.
So did you find anything that really amazed you or surprised you?
Well, yeah, I mean, some of the oral histories that we collected are spectacular. There's one that I encourage people to watch. It's on the map near Chimney Rock. And it was, we met up with a man named Bob Case who saw a bull caribou just below Chimney Rock. And he said it was a life-changing experience. And the same goes for Brad Smith, who's a Sandpoint local who works for I forget the name of the conservation organization there, maybe the Selkirk Alliance or...
Conservation
Alliance. Yeah, right. He saw caribou in his early 20s. So that was a formative experience for him, which led him to get involved in conservation. And so the collection of these stories and their clear impact on these individuals was a really moving experience for us.
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing a little bit more about the broader topic of extinction and your combination of the humanities and extinctions in the world. We're here in North Idaho, we're dealing with the one species of the caribou, and they still exist in Canada, but not here, if unless I'm incorrect on that. But in other parts of the world and other areas, folks are also writing about extinction. So how did that play into your thinking about this project?
Well, the framework for this project was inspired by some kind of reading that we did in one of our courses, an environmental humanities course here, about extinction and kind of responding to extinction events. And that's where we got the idea of storying extinction and kind of thinking about this essay talked about storytelling as an ethical practice and as a form of response to the loss of species or the potential loss of species. And one of the things that you know, I've thought a lot about personally in, you know, we live in an age of mass extinction. That's what, you know, we read about in our studies, and a lot of people are talking about. This is kind of, we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction. I don't know how many species are going extinct each day, but it's an overwhelming moment living in. And one of the questions that arises for all of us is, how do you respond to something that seems so onerous and so kind of beyond our reach to actually do something about, especially, you know, we know the caribou, there were several augmentation efforts, really, you know, solid efforts to protect these animals, but they just didn't have the habitat to keep them to survive, right? And so a lot of this project, you know, it's something that can be applied to more cases of extinction, and thinking about how do you respond to something that feels so almost impossible to respond to. And I think that goes for climate change more broadly. And what are the small things that we can do as humans who care to try to make a difference? And what we're doing here is not necessarily trying to bring caribou back, but trying to make a space within which we can kind of dwell with the experience of these losses, the experience of extinction, the experience of climate change, kind of think about what it means to be human sharing in that experience, and to be human sharing that experience with more than human being, other than human beings, you know. And so the storytelling or the oral history component of this project is kind of a way to process and you know, to also recognize that, you know, the part of the deep map, and one of the things that's most compelling about the deep map is that it's open-ended. It's not a finished product. It's not representing space as something that's complete. It's representing space as something that's open-ended. There are game camera videos of bears passing by a space, but you don't know, you don't see kind of the kind of progression or the ending of that passage. And the same thing goes for the map and all of these stories, that hopefully it kind of reveals the way in which we're still telling this story. This in extinction is not one singular moment in time. It's we often think of it as that, but it's a long process, and this is just part of that process. And we're kind of imagining how, you know, what our place within that process is right now.
It's a big topic, and yeah, extinction is a process, and so is the way that habitat and systems change over time. Big processes. What do you, with the work you've done, what do you see for the future of caribou in our region? Are they done? And the future of the woodland caribou as they've been transported north to other places here. What's the prognosis long-term for the species?
Well, we're not biologists, but I'll try to answer your question anyways. The mountain caribou are definitely in trouble. even those animals in BC, the populations are trending downward. And I'll add that like we can split hairs over extirpation versus extinction. Aren't mountain caribou all equal? We might not have them in Idaho, but as long as we have them in Canada, you know, we're safe. What does it matter? But almost all extinctions start locally. To go back to Chris's point, which is why it's so important to respond locally to this greater issue, which is only, I would argue, instantiated as a universal, as a broader and more frightening topic because of these smaller and local interactions that we have with the space around us. And in the case of mountain caribou, yeah, they're in trouble precisely because we're not thinking locally about our role in their ecosystems.
Right. You know, so many species that have been on the verge of extinction have had a helper, like a celebrity or a cause. I'm thinking of course, like Jane Goodall and that sort of thing. Is there anybody speaking for the caribou, the mountain caribou at this point? And if not, who do we need? The smile on my face, you guys, but of course our listeners can't see it. It's a tough one, right? It's such an emotional topic.
That's the problem. Animals don't speak. It's important to remember that and honor it in a way. Go ahead, Phil.
It's an important story you guys have helped to get out and to bring into the public consciousness. Lots of big issues for us all to think about, not just with the caribou, but really how we relate to the landscape and how it changes over time and what our role and responsibilities are in that, shaping that. I think this is a good jumping off point for people to do a little bit of self-reflecting on that. And in that vein, what is next for both of you? Another joint project, individual projects, or where do you go from here? Jack, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, another joint project, a similar project in a way. Maybe we're just morose individuals, but it's another project about a kind of extinction, a kind of cultural extinction of the fire lookout tower. It's a deep mapping project that seeks to preserve the history and lived experiences of fire lookouts in Idaho and to consider their role in the shaping of our forests and ecosystems and recreational sites. And that project we just started, and it'll take some time to complete, but yeah, we're excited about it.
Yeah, so I'm not going to call you morose. Let's maybe go with reflective. There's a lot of self-study in these sorts of topics. And I love the idea of the fire towers because Phil and I have interviewed at least two fire tower workers, and they are reflective souls, aren't they, Phil? Very much love spending their solitary time in the towers.
So Chris, tell us more about what your horizon holds. It sounds like you're working with Jack, but let's get your spin on it.
Yeah, we both graduated in the spring from this master's program. Jack's going on to a PhD, and I'm going to apply to PhD programs, but taking a little bit of time off just to give myself a break. So in the meantime, working on this fire lookout project, I'm imagining that extending, what we're doing right now is kind of a pilot project because as you can imagine, there are many, many lookout sites, I think 190 still standing, potentially active lookouts in Idaho at the moment, close to 1,000 at one point in history. And so this is a project that we're doing basically a pilot project this summer. And then hopefully we'll get more funding to turn it into something larger. So it could become, I'm imagining working through the fall on this pilot project. And then hopefully if we get some funding, it could become a kind of PhD research project and continuing to do. So we're working also with the same department at the library that supported the Caribou project to learn more about kind of the nuts and bolts of building websites and putting these deep maps together. So hopefully eventually we can do it all on our own.
Yeah, so hard to combine your creative talents with your practical talents, but if anyone can do it, I see some determination in your faces.
And there's a lot of interest in fire towers in our area. There's rich, deep cultural history here. And one of the ways people relate to the landscape in an almost universal way. Both of you are probably aware there's an excellent article in this summer's edition of Sandpoint Magazine, which has just recently been out. If you haven't seen it, it's online, about the history of fire towers in our region. And it's a starting point. I think you could arguably go a lot deeper, and the deep map approach to it, I think, would carry it another step further. But there's a ready appetite here for it.
I have to say, I love that term, deep map. Can't wait to see one.
Well, as we wrap up today's episode of Community Conversations, any final thoughts for us, Jack, Chris?
I just, one thing that, you know, as we've emphasized already, this is ongoing, and we'd really like if anybody has a story that they'd like to share about encountering caribou. We really want more perspectives for the project. The Kalispell tribe was mentioned earlier. We really would like some tribal perspectives because we know the caribou have been very important to them too. So if there's anybody out there.
Yeah, no kidding. I'd like to hear more stories about them. For me, it's a kind of a sadly emotional topic because 2 years ago we were trying to bolster that population, and now we're talking about extirpation. It's happened just in two short years.
For someone who has some story to add, what's the best way for them to connect with you, Chris?
Our emails, clamb, L-A-M-B at uidaho.edu, and jcredell, K-R-E-D-E-L-L at uidaho.edu. Just shoot us an email.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bill and Julie.
Yeah, thanks
for the opportunity. Great interview. Yeah, so concluding our conversation for this morning's Community Conversations, we've been joined by Chris Lamb and Jack Credell, University of Idaho English grad students, talking about storing extinction, responding to the loss of North Idaho's mountain caribou. Thank you.
Thank you.